Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's March 4th, 2021. We are hearing two oral arguments this morning via zoom.gov, our new arrangement, which hopefully is not going to last forever. Marshall, will you call the second case?
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Werke, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Lucinda Jessen presiding. The case is A20-1153, Kathleen Court versus Matthew John Larson and Kylie Rogers Special Needs Trust.
Thank you. Well, counsel, the same basic rules apply here virtually as they do in our courtroom. So counsel for appellant, we get 15 minutes for argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. We have two respondents here, and I understand that you are splitting the 15 minutes between the two of you. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Yes, right.
Well, and you see that we do have a clock in one of the screens here. So the marshal during that time will kind of set the clock accordingly so that we can all keep track of time together. I'd ask all of you when you begin your arguments to introduce yourself at the beginning. We do record these and make the recordings available of our oral arguments on our website. If there are technical difficulties, such as that you think you can be seen and we can't or vice versa, please let us know. We'll stop the clock, we'll get them fixed, and we'll move on because we really want to hear from all of you. With that, counsel for appellant, I'll turn to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Brian Stauffer, and I'm here on behalf of the plaintiff and appellant, Kathleen Cordy. This case arises out of a slip and fall incident that happened on November 12th, 2016. At a single family residence, which was owned by the trust and leased to the father of Kylie Rogers, Mr. Larson. We are appealing the district court's order granting summary judgment to both of the defendants, finding that neither of them had a duty under the situation. And we are asking the court to vacate that order and to remand this matter back for a trial. I'll start out by saying that most of the facts outlined in the judge's memorandum are generally accurate. And so I'll be touching on those and pointing out where they're in fact not accurate.
But before you get to the facts, because that leads us down to an analysis of the case on the merits. And I don't think we're gonna get to the merits yet. We'll have to hear from you on that, but let's talk about the elephant in the room that's been raised by both respondent counsel. For you to have something reviewed by the Court of Appeals, you first of all have to establish this claim, preserve this claim in district court. So we have both the trust and we have Mr. Larson. And if you have not adequately preserved the issue, it's deemed waived. Why would we not dismiss your action outright with even getting to the merits? Here's what I want to know. Tell us for both the trust and then, of course, for Mr. Larson. Where was this adequately preserved?
I think it was adequately preserved both in my respondent brief to the motion in for summary judgment and at the time of the hearing, the issues that should be reviewed by this court.
Specifically, can you tell me what it is that, can you tell me what it is that you're relying on?
Sure. So this is a fairly straightforward premises liability case, which should be analyzed under the restatement of torts and the Larson versus Larson case. Specifically, let me touch on both of them. As to the tenant, Mr. Larson, his legal duties are to maintain the premises. And we've pointed out that he failed to maintain this handicap ramp in a reasonable way. We're not arguing duty to warn. We're not arguing duty to remove ice and snow. We're arguing the general duty to maintain your premises. And under the lease agreement, which I'll get back to, he was in general responsible for maintenance. So my position is fairly straightforward, and I've articulated this to the court. Did Mr. Larson have notice of a dangerous condition on the handicap ramp? And the facts say, yes, they do, because he put these anti-skid strips on half of the slats. Right.
Now again, we're going to the merits of the case. If this was in fact preserved at district court, what authority do you have that a lessee of property is in fact responsible to another individual? I mean, that has to do with beyond the fact that you have to preserve the issue, but you have to articulate your legal basis for that in appellate court. Do you have legal authority?
Right. And all in general, in Minnesota, most premises liability cases come off of the Larson versus Larson case and their articulation of the restatement of torts as to the duty of a, quote, possessor of land. That's the language that the Minnesota Supreme Court and this court have used over and over again as the duty of possessor of land. Mr. Larson was the possessor of land. So the possessor of land has a duty to maintain the premises in a reasonably safe manner.
How do you apply that reasoning to the trust?
Well,
I'll be fair to you. Are you relying on the same argument both for the trust as well as it applies to Mr. Larson?
It's slightly different because in the cases cited by the defendants, they rely heavily on Oakland and its progeny and other cases. Those in this case, the duties of the trust are outlined in the written lease agreement. So other cases that they've cited, they all say, for example, in Oakland, they say there is
no. Well, you're calling it duty. To me, it sounds more like a responsibility. A duty to whom?
Well, in general, the question kind of becomes, do they maintain any control or possession of the land? And if you look at the White versus Many Waters case, they talk about whether or not the landlord maintains control. And one of the things they look at is, in fact, is there a lease agreement that defines that control or defines those responsibilities or duties? They're the same.
So I want to ask a question, follow-up question there. And this goes to the issue you just raised, the control issue. Did you raise that issue before the district court? And if I'm basically asking the same question of how is that issue preserved? Because that seems to be the issue that you are now raising on appeal, which is different than the issue that you raised to the district court. So why isn't that issue of control waived on appeal?
If you look at my responsive brief, Your Honor, you will see that in the oral arguments, they argued Oakland as controlling on this particular case. And I said, in response, I said, no, they maintain control over a portion of the property through the lease agreement, or at least they had some control over the property through the lease agreement.
And when you say they, who are you referring to? To whom are you referring?
Excuse me. I'm referring to the trust. If you look at the lease agreement, in general, they give the responsibility to do maintenance to the tenant, but the landlord, the trust, maintains that they have control over any maintenance or repairs over $100.
I understand how you're interpreting duty, but what case law are you relying on that the trust or the landlord of property had this duty? That's what I'm looking for, is something to support your contention or your interpretation under the rule.
And I'm not sure I understand, but the way I would phrase it is Lewis versus Lewis and the restatement of torts defines the general duties of a possessor of land. And that can be the owner, that can be the tenant. That can be, there's a case, a Bundy case, where it's a former owner of property that comes in to get flowers out of a flower bed. And they said they, at that time, were the possessors of land.
Is there a Minnesota case that you can point us to that would back that up?
Yes, let me grab that.
I don't want you to use your time on oral argument looking for authority. If you know what it is, or perhaps when you come back for a rebuttal, you could bring that to our attention.
It's right here, Your Honor. Bundy, B-U-N-D-Y versus Holmquist, H-O-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. It's a Minnesota Court of Appeals decision, 669 Northwest 2nd, 627, and it's a 2003 case. And that's a case involving flower beds and somebody stepping into a hole in a flower bed after the property had been sold. Any other questions at this point? All right, so let me, as long as we're in general talking facts, one of the facts or one of the issues on the facts that is somewhat concerning to me is the issue of whether or not the tenant told the nurses to use a different door and to use steps instead of a instead of the ramp. And I initially didn't give much weight to that because I do not believe that changes the legal status of Ms. Corti. Ms. Corti was under old language an invitee, but certainly an entrant under modern up-to-date Minnesota law. The fact that whether or not Larson said use the front door rather than the side door, or use the steps rather than the lamp, two things. Number one, it doesn't change her legal status. And number two, if it's material fact, it's certainly disputed. Ms. Corti says she was never told to use the front sidewalk or front steps and was told that she should use the side side ramp. So looking at that, it seems to me that Mr. Larson had notice because somebody, doesn't matter who, put those grip strips down. So whoever put those grip strips down had noticed that something was wrong and that that was required to remedy a situation.
Isn't that really speculation or conjecture as to why those strips were put down?
It doesn't, it goes to notice, and I don't think putting anti-slip strips down isn't speculative. People put anti-slip strips down so people don't slip. That's what the purpose of them is.
But you're trying to tie it to snow and ice. Isn't the usual remedy to shovel it or sweep it or put salt down if you have slippery conditions such as that? Versus, because I mean, if you get snow and ice on something, it's going to cover up those strips. Those strips aren't going to do much of anything at all with respect to ice.
Well, so the reason we focus on the strips is simply for the notice issue. Did he have notice that that ramp, absent snow and ice,
but was in isn't a slippery isn't condition? That a, isn't really a your argument seems so general. I mean, isn't really the issue of whether or not there was notice of ice on the ground in the morning when she left? Not whether or not it generally will ice up. I mean, otherwise you could have a liability for anybody, whether it's sleet or ice or snow or rain, whatever. It doesn't, don't we have to focus on what the condition was in that particular day, that morning?
No, we do not. What we have to focus on is what was.
Why don't we? I don't understand that, because case law, we've had lots of case law on these issues of these slips and falls, and you have to have notice that there was actually ice at that time or dangerous conditions at that time. Not generally. We live in Minnesota. We deal with snow and ice 9 months out of the year, it seems like sometimes. Don't we have to have notice of that particular time?
No, we have to have notice of a hazardous condition. If you look at the Oakland case, there was no snow and ice. This is a fall down a basement set of stairs. The issue is that a dangerous hazard? Is that a hazard that the landlord or the tenant should have remedied? And so the same is true as far as the ramp. We have to look at in general, even before we get to the presence of frost, in general, was that in an unreasonable condition? And if it is, or if at least that's a question of fact, then it goes to the jury. The jury should be deciding if that was an unsafe condition before the ice developed. And for that purpose, the skid strips, or whatever we want to call them, friction strips, are evidence that someone had noticed that there was a slippery condition. Those weren't put on in response to the frost. Those were put on before the frost, and they were put on incorrectly. And I think that's a key. that they attempted to remedy a situation and they failed to remedy it correctly. They didn't put enough slip strips on there and my client fell in between and broke her hip. And so whether or not that was an appropriate remedy, whether that was a reasonable remedy to the known condition is again a question of fact for the jury. And the jury can decide that that wasn't adequate notice, and the jury can decide that that was a reasonable attempt to remedy the situation, but that should be decided by the jury. The simple question of, did he have a duty to maintain the ramp? The answer is yes. Yes, he did. The question of whether he failed in that duty is a question of fact for the jury in this case. And they shouldn't get a free pass by in anything. It's the court that made some assumptions that were incorrect. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. We will turn to respondents. Who is going first?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay. Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors and Counsel. May it please the court. My name is Brian Varland, and I'm here on behalf of respondent Matthew John Larson, who respectfully requests that the court affirm the judgment of the district court. This case involves what the Supreme Court in Mattson versus St. Luke's Hospital of St. Paul said over a half century ago. It involves a normal hazard of life in Minnesota, walking on uncertain surfaces in freezing weather. The appellant in this case has asked the court to impose a duty of extraordinary care to prevent all risk and to make Mr. Larson an insurer of her absolute safety. Minnesota law does not require as much. A duty of reasonable care requires a claimant to present evidence, not just speculation or conjecture, of foreseeable risk of injury. And there is no duty as a matter of law to keep outside steps and walkways free of frozen moisture at all times. The law allows a reasonable length of time for its removal from outside entrance walks, platforms, or steps.
Mr. Varlin,
yes.
You're speaking on behalf of Mr. Larson, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. Do you feel that the issue was adequately raised in district court? And if so, is it properly before us and was it properly briefed on the duty to your client?
Your Honor, that's a very good question. I'm cognizant of the idea of Thiel versus Stitch, and as far as preserving issues, precise issues, I don't think the issue of the tenant perhaps was preserved at the district court. With that being said, I do acknowledge, as some of the case law that we cite in our brief does use the word possessor, and so if possessor means tenant, then perhaps the issue should be preserved, but those cases do not say tenant. That is true, and I don't think that precise issue was necessarily addressed at the district court level. I will, however, defer to the court's analysis of what the court thinks the cases say in that regard. Now, the district court in this case did correctly dismiss the Ms. Corte's negligence action because the undisputed facts demonstrate Mr. Larson was not notified of any slippery condition on the ramp outside of his residence prior to the 6 a.m. fall on recently formed hoarfrost, which is the term coined by Ms. Corte, that had formed overnight. And at the time, Mr. Larson was asleep by Ms. Corte's own admission. With Ms. Corte's arguments to the district court and to this court, they offer only remote possibilities and non-expert speculation as to the ramp slope and design and modification. They suggest what Mr. Larson could have done or known in order to be an insurer of her absolute safety. Ms. Corte thinks this case should be, quote, quite simple and suggests that Mr. Larson being a possessor it ends the matter. It doesn't. If that was all that was required to demonstrate duty, then there would be no need for courts to consider other factors such as foreseeability and context as discussed in the cases we cite in our brief, including the Peterson case from 1972, the Foss versus Kincaid case, and this court's own decision, which I welcome the court to take a close look at, Wren versus Minnesota State Agricultural Society, that was decided in the year 2000. In that case, this court described the duty as a duty to use reasonable care to prevent persons from being injured by conditions on property that represent foreseeable risk of injury. Foreseeability is a key criterion in this case. And there was not foreseeability, contrary to what counsel on the other side has argued. There is, by her own admission, Ms. Corte never informed Mr. Larson of any concerns that she had with the ramp. He testified clearly that no one informed him prior to the fall of any concerns with the ramp. I want to get into the issue that was just raised on the other side in the arguments this morning and the questions the court had about notice and the grip strips. You know, by that analysis, if there's grip strips on a ramp that suggests that there's a hazard, then that would mean that handrails on steps would mean those are hazards for which anyone who falls on steps could make a successful claim for negligence. That is not the law in Minnesota. And there's the added factor that the court asked about looking to the circumstances of that morning. That is critical. That is what is alleged in this case. The hoarfrost was formed during the night. And to look at the condition of that case puts this case within the Mattson rule and all the progeny, including the many cases this court has decided in the years since Mattson was decided, affirming summary judgment dismissal of negligence claims when there was allowance for a reasonable time after the formation of the frozen moisture, ice, or snow. That is what this case is about. Mr. Larson was asleep at the time. There wasn't the opportunity to go out and clear the hoarfrost. And so that's something to consider as far as the duty owed in this case and the elements that it is the burden of the appellant to have made to demonstrate negligence. The district court did correctly rule that that showing was not made. And with that, Your Honors, I will reserve the rest of the time for the counsel for the other respondent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I apologize, counsel, for not reset, having the clock reset to make sure that you each had exactly the half of the argument. But counsel for the trust, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Derek Harvey, appearing on behalf of respondent Kylie Rogers Special Needs Trust. May it please the court. So since respondent filed its motion for summary judgment in April 2020, appellant's arguments in opposition have been a moving target. We filed our motion on the grounds that the trust was a lessor, and under Minnesota law, lessors cannot be held liable for conditions on land which exists at the time the premises are leased unless one of four exceptions applied. And we walked through the four exceptions and explained why they didn't apply. In its response to the trust motion for summary judgment, appellant argued that the trust was negligent because, quote, it built the ramp, and because, quote, the trust should have used reasonable care in the construction of the ramp and the selection of materials. In its response memorandum, appellant did not cite any authority in support of this argument. It did not address the trust landlord liability arguments. It did not argue that whether the trust maintained control over the property is a question of fact. It did not argue that any of the landlord liability exceptions espoused in Oakland applied. And in fact, it did not address Oakland or the exceptions contained therein at all. As a result, both the trust and the district court were essentially forced to guess as to what appellant's legal arguments and authorities were. And Judge Dana Colfin's opinion actually reflects this. You can see there's a line in there where she expressly states that she's not sure what exactly the parties are arguing about, but quote, it appears that the parties may be arguing about whether or not the ramp constitutes a hidden defect. And then she went on to discuss the hidden defect exception in detail. She did say that she summarily noted that the trust did not maintain control over the premises in her opinion, but she did not elaborate on that because she did not understand that appellant was making that argument. In order for an issue to be preserved for appeal, the issue must be, quote, presented to and considered by the trial court. So that requires the appellant to have introduced significant or sufficient argument and authority such that the district court actually knew what he was arguing and can rule on it. And as I mentioned before, I believe the district court's opinion reflected that she did not have the requisite information to really understand what the argument was and to rule on it. In Brodsky versus Brodsky, a 2007 appellate decision by this court specifically noted that, quote, an issue raised only in a conclusory fashion and without supporting affidavits or testimony or argument is not properly raised before the district court. So because appellant failed to adequately brief any control arguments at the district court did not consider those arguments and instead assumed that the appellant was making an entirely different argument. As a result, this issue was just not raised at the district court. It wasn't decided at the district court and therefore not raised for appeal. And then the second but related issue is whether or not the issue was adequately briefed on appeal. And again, the issue was not adequately briefed on appeal. On appeal, appellant changed his argument. Instead of arguing that the trust should have used reasonable care in the construction of the ramp and selection of materials, appellant now argues on appeal that the court improperly found that the trust did not maintain any control of the property at the time of the fall. Once again, on appeal though, appellant failed to cite any legal authority in support of this argument, save for one unpublished court of appeals opinion that has nothing to do with landlord liability. Literally the only case cited in support of its arguments regarding the trust at the appellate court was an unpublished case called Nelson versus Town Homes at Water's Edge, Inc. But Nelson had nothing to do with landlord liability. In Nelson, one of the defendants was a homeowners association and the other defendant was a management company that was tasked with maintaining common areas. And the issue, the salient issue in that case was whether the association assumed a duty to conduct snow removal for a homeowner by verbally promising to do so. That case had nothing to do with landlord liability and it had nothing to do with the four exceptions that apply to landlord liability. But then upon filing its reply brief, appellant changed its argument again and now appears to be arguing that the trust was actually a possessor of real property and not a landlord. Appellant doesn't cite any legal authority at all for the proposition that the trust is a possessor and not a landlord. And because this argument was raised for the first time in the reply, I didn't have an adequate opportunity to respond to it. Our brief doesn't contain any discussions about the distinction between landlords and possessors, for example. Appellant failed to adequately brief her arguments on appeal. And because of this, her argument should be deemed waived. To hold otherwise would be extremely prejudicial to the trust, who has been trying to figure out what exactly appellant is arguing since day one. The trust has likewise not been given an adequate opportunity to brief arguments raised for the first time in appellant's reply brief, such that the new argument that the trust was actually a possessor and not a landlord. But turning to the merits, even if the court does find that the control issue was properly raised, which of course we believe it shouldn't, appellant's control argument fails as a matter of law, quite clearly. This court has previously held that the common law exception arising from landlord control allows for a duty of care if the landlord retains possession of an apartment's common areas like stairs, halls, elevators, and yard space. So Minnesota law distinguishes between the property that is actually leased from property that is appurtenant to the leased that the lessee has permission to use, but is not necessarily within its right of possession. For example, in Geislinger versus Village of Watkins, a landlord was found to be liable for maintaining a stairway because it was a common area that all tenants in the complex could use. And then on the other side of the coin, in Bigos versus Cluender, another case we cited in brief, the landlord was held to not have a duty to maintain a deck, like a porch on the backside of the apartment, because the deck was a part of the lease premise, not appurtenant to the lease premise, and nobody else had any right to use that deck. Another example, Rosmo versus Amherst Holding Company. In that case, the landlord was held to have a duty to maintain an alleyway behind the apartment complex that all tenants had a right to use. All these cases concern common areas. common areas that more than one tenant have the right to use. And the court actually, this court, squarely addressed the specific argument being made here that a landlord's agreement to perform certain maintenance items is sufficient to satisfy the control exception. So that case is White versus Many Rivers West Limited Partnership, I believe it is. And that's a 2011 Court of Appeals decision. In that case, the plaintiff slash tenants brought suit against their landlord after their toddler fell through a three-story window. And the theory of liability was that the landlord in the lease, by the way, in the written lease, had an obligation to perform maintenance on the windows. And they argued that because the landlord retained control over the repair and maintenance of the window screens, they owed a duty of care. And this court disagreed. They said, no, the control exception only applies to common areas. It does not apply to maintenance agreements, such as the one at issue here. The only obligation the lease had here was to make major repairs, which as a policy matter, I'd like to point out that the vast majority of residential leases reserve to the lessor the obligation to make major repairs like this. If this court were to hold that that's enough to establish control and landlord liability, the exception would essentially swallow the rule. And that's not in accord with Minnesota precedent. There's no good reason for this court to overturn such established precedent. So for those reasons and the reasons discussed in brief, respondent Kylie Rogers Special Needs Trust respectfully requests the court affirm the district court's judgment dismissing appellant's claims against the trust with prejudice and on the merits. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me start out by talking about the White versus Many Rivers West case that the attorney for the trust just cited to. He is absolutely incorrect in his summary of that case. In that case, there was no written lease agreement. In fact, all the cases cited by the respondent trust involve cases where there is no written lease agreement. And so when they talk about the common law duties, they are misleading this court because you are not to be focused on the common law duties, you're to be focused on the lease agreement. In fact, the judge in her memorandum says, absent a written agreement, this is the common law, and then goes on to analyze this case according to the common law. That is not the situation here. Here you have to address it according to the lease agreement. In the White case, what the plaintiff tried to do is say that notices sent out about repairs of maintenance of windows would constituted a written agreement. And the court said, no, we find there is no written agreement. In this case, in our case, there is a written agreement. So White doesn't apply to specifically the situation in this case. Oakland doesn't apply to the situation in this case. If you read the cases they cited, they all talk about the fact that there is no written lease agreement.
To the White case, do you agree that the decision in the White case would cause us to assume that making a decision of control would be a question of law, not a question of fact?
Well, it's a little different, again, because of the issue. Yes, in general, whether or not there is any evidence of control over the property is a question of law.
And that could be summarily decided if it's a question of law.
It could be, but it should not be decided based on common law. It should be decided based on the lease agreement. In the other cases cited, they were looking for, did the landlord maintain control over common areas? We're not making that argument here. We're arguing that the landlord, under its lease agreement, maintained a duty or control or was a possessor. And I'm a little confused by that argument because as I read the restatement of courts and as I read the Lewis versus Lewis case, they all look at whether or not someone is a possessor of land. That's the analysis the court looks at. It doesn't look at whether or not absent agreement, whether it only applies to landlords or tenants or someone else. In general, the courts of Minnesota have said, this is the duty of a possessor of land. So the issue becomes, did the landlord maintain a position as a possessor of land? And I'm saying, with respect, when you look at the lease agreement, they did. because they maintain control or power over repairs over $100. So if they wanted to defeat this case, what they should have done is come in and say, listen, repairs on this ramp would have cost more than $100 or less than $100, therefore we didn't have to do anything. They did not do that because they don't want to admit that repairs were necessary. So they haven't proven that their provisions of the lease agreement that give them the right to control repairs over $100, they haven't ever shown that that doesn't apply in this case.
So, counsel, I have a question for you on the, let's assume that the issues are not waived and we actually do get to the merits. Is your position that it's the hoarfrost that caused her to slip?
It's our position that the ramp was slippery before the hoarfrost came and that the hoarfrost made the situation worse and more slippery.
Okay, I'm a little confused because Ms. Corte herself actually stated that she did not remember that there were any problems before on the ramp with respect to snow or ice, but then that the hoarfrost that morning is what she slipped on. I thought that was your position, is it was a hoarfrost.
It's the combination, Your Honor. It's the combination of hoarfrost, but also no grip strips on the remaining slats. It's those two things together that caused her to fall.
So, okay, I'm having a hard time understanding that argument, but with respect to the hoarfrost,
okay,
we've got the Mattson case from 1958 from the Minnesota Supreme Court, a long line of cases that basically talk about foreseeability and that it's not reasonable to expect a landowner to clear off hoarfrost, ice, snow, before, you know, that occurs overnight. And this seems to fall squarely under Mattson, where she explicitly says she did not see any problems before. She didn't say hoarfrost. She said she did not see any problems before that evening when she arrived there. And then when she left, that she slipped on the hoarfrost. Why doesn't that defeat your claim right then and there and allow the district court to grant summary judgment as district courts have done over and over and over for decades?
It doesn't defeat it, Your Honor. I agree. If it was snow and ice only, or I think it's a little difficult saying hoarfrost as far as when did it accumulate, because it's not an accumulation from a storm, as is the Mattson case and the cases cited there under. But I would say the difference is the notice of the tenant to a previous pre-existing dangerous condition that was made worse. They gave the example of handrails. If you put up handrails on only part of the ramp, then there has to be a question as to why wasn't it put on the entire ramp? And if you fell because there were no handrails on part of the ramp, the fact that there were handrails on the other part of the ramp doesn't get you off of liability. In fact, it shows you had noticed that there should be handrails. The fact that they put the grip strips down shows they had noticed they should put something down to prevent this from happening. And the fact that they did not remedy this hazard completely is the issue that should go to the jury.
Thank you. Are there other questions from the panel? Well, if not, thank you so much for your helpful briefing and arguments. The matter is taken under advisement and a decision will be issued within the statutory time period.